Hi, my name is Andre Traversa. I am co-host and producer of The Cosmic Citizen. This is our first show here debuting on blogtalkradio.com. The Cosmic Citizen is a show that is devoted primarily to the study of the teachings of the Urantia Book. The Urantia Book is a book that we believe is a revelation from angels and other beings given to us in this day and generation to expand our awareness of truth and cosmic consciousness and all kinds of other good stuff. With me is my lovely co-host, Paula Thompson. Paula, say hi to our audience.
Hi there.
Hi there. Paula is a longtime reader as well of the Urantia Book, and today we're going to introduce our listeners to the book. For those who don't know what the Urantia Book is, let me spell that for you. It's U-R-A-N-T-I-A. That's U-R-A-N-T-I-A, Urantia. So we're going to do kind of what I call a Dick and Jane show today. We're going to introduce people to the basics of the Urantia Book, and the next four shows, in fact, after this one, we'll talk more in depth about the content of the Urantia Book. So without further ado, let me introduce my guest, or our guest, I should say. Our guest is James Woodward. James Woodward has been a reader of the Urantia Book for 35 years. He has he is former executive director of the Urantia Association International. He has been a staff member with the Urantia Foundation. And is currently is doing some interesting work. James, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Andre. Thank you for inviting me. It's wonderful to be here, and good morning to you and Paula and to all those who might be listening out there.
Great, great. James, tell us what you're doing now. I just gave you the listeners a little background about you. What are you doing now? You kind of took a hiatus from the Urantia Association International. What are you doing instead?
Currently, I'm working with an author, Sheila Keen Lund, another longtime reader of the book, who has been working on a manuscript for the last 10 years that's a reconciliation of the teachings of the Urantia Book with a vast array of human knowledge as to the origin, history, and destiny of what we have in our current volume of knowledge on the planet.
James, tell us, so let's just... You know, I think most of our listeners right now are probably going to be people who... Oh, by the way, let me give the call-in number before I forget. Our call-in number, if anybody wants to ask questions of James or I or Paula or any of us, you can reach us at 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. That number should be on your screen, but I will repeat it again a few times during the show. But James, tell us, for those who don't know, what is the Urantia Book and what does the word Urantia mean?
Well, the word Urantia is not defined within the text of the Urantia Book anywhere, but it does refer to our planet. There's been some interesting etymological studies done as far as the background of the word itself. If you go into the Greek and trace it back in that direction, most people agree that it tends to refer to it as something of like a heavenly place. And there are some references, say from the Greek, Uranos does mean heaven. In ancient Greek mythology, Urania was the muse of astronomy. So there are some etymological background references to the word Urantia. But in any case, it does mean, refers to our planet. If you were living somewhere else in this vast universe and were referring to this habited planet in our solar system, you would say, you're from Urantia.
Okay. So Urantia is basically a proper name given to our planet.
Andre, I'd like to interrupt a little bit here.
Sure.
I want to interject that I love the etymology of that word, and it is a word coined by the authors of the book. And when you think of it that way, and I'm sure you do, James, too, having been into serving readers out there, there's some confusion with new people about that word. It is not another planet. It is their term for this planet, the planet we call Earth, our home, and it essentially means just that, our home in the heavens, our place in the heavens. We call it Earth, but another word for it is Urantia. So I just wanted to make that clear because I do get some confusion from people thinking that we're claiming to be from another planet. I don't know if you've ever gotten that, but.
Yes, I have. Thanks for the clarification, Paula.
Sure.
And Paula, please feel free to interrupt me anytime and jump in, because as a co-host, that is your right and privilege, so that's perfectly okay with me.
Okay, thanks, John.
And I want this to be a nice back and forth here. We don't have to worry about, you can interject, interrupt anytime. So what I want to ask you, James, so for those of you who don't know, so we know that Urantia is the name of our planet. So what is the Urantia book, and who gave it to us and why?
Well, I guess to begin with, we'd have to say that the Urantia book claims to be a revelation to mankind. It does give us a fresh and enlarged view of the cosmos. It reveals new information about deity and reality. It also reveals information on the origin, history, and destiny of our planet, Urantia, and especially the destiny of each individual member of the human race. The book offers inspired teachings, and also reconciles it with a modern scientific approach. Interestingly, we're told that the universe is teeming with life and intelligence, and that there's a divine plan behind its design and purpose. And also that from time to time, spiritual beings that hail from other parts of the universe are mandated to impart information to people on worlds such as ours, to assist us in our evolutionary growth, both physical, intellectual, and spiritual.
Tell me, so it claims to be a revelation from who?
Well, it claims to be a revelation of truth from a wide array of, higher intelligences, actually an organized staff of higher intelligences, and transmitted through the mind circuits of a mysterious, unknown sleeping subject.
Okay.
Some of the topics, the array of topics in the Urantia book is, it's astounding. A quick list, you could say that it covers anatomy, anthropology, astronomy, biology, chemistry, cosmology, criminology, economics, education, evolution, genetics, geology, government, history, philosophy, religion, medicine, physics, psychology, sociology, family, marriage, and science.
You know, I like
that's just a short list.
I like to think of the Urantia book as a love letter from the universe, from a friendly and well-ordered universe. And the very fact when you first start to read it, it resonates with such a high level of intelligence. And, you know, that's intimidating to some people at first. And, you know, James, your list, I am interested in all of those things. Now that I've read the book, but when I was 20 and I first started to read, that was 33 years ago, I didn't even know I was interested in those things. But it illuminates our own human condition in such a way. It's like, the view from 60,000 feet, all the pieces of the puzzle start to just fall in place. And that's really the beauty of it, is the interrelatedness of all of those things you just mentioned and how they are relevant in our human lives.
You know, James, let me ask you this question. Paula just mentioned that the Urantia book, she sees the book as a love letter from the universe to us, from a friendly universe to us here on this world. I've heard a lot of people refer to the Bible that way as well. There are, biblical Christians who believe the Bible is a love letter, is God's love letter to humanity. Why do we need the Urantia book? Isn't the Bible enough?
Well, yes, I do think that the Bible is enough. Depending on your personal view of the cosmos, what we've found, I think, through the advances of science, advances in intellectual reasoning, that there are some groups of people or individuals who the Bible isn't satisfying, and the Urantia book does provide advanced concepts. It provides advanced theology as well as advanced scientific and cosmological insight.
So it's there to give us a lot of new information and give us an expanded view of the universe. I mean, the Bible, I don't want to get into the pros and cons. The Bible, for whatever you want to think about it, the Bible only refers to our planet. It doesn't refer to any other worlds, really. And so is one of the reasons the book here is here, is it to give us an expanded view of the universe and our place in it?
Well, absolutely. It expands cosmic consciousness, and to enhance spiritual perception are one of the reasons that it's given right at the very beginning of the Urantia book, of its purpose to our people.
You know, I'd like to add something on that topic too, Andre. I find it interesting when people feel like one bit of information is enough. I don't think it's ever enough for a growing, healthy person to be satisfied with just one answer for all questions. And, you know, it's like saying, well, my child graduated 12th grade, that's enough. Yeah, my child doesn't need to go to college because 12th grade is enough. What else is there to know? They've learned all they can. I think, you know, and one thing that hasn't been mentioned is that a full third of the book is devoted to the life and teachings of Jesus. And Jesus as a cosmic person and Jesus as a human being on this planet is throughout the book. And one thing that Jesus said that always stays with me is he said, seek and you will find, ask and you will be answered. Knock, and the door will be opened unto you. And I think, well, if there was nothing new to find, why would he have said that? If there were no questions unanswered, why should we ask? And so, and he also said, behold, the old things are passing away. All things are becoming new. Why would he have said that if there was nothing new to discover, if there were no new discoveries to make? And so I think that, you know, it's a shame to me that people don't look beyond just one aspect. I understand the Bible is satisfying, deeply satisfying to most people, but I don't think they should be afraid to venture beyond it.
Yeah, and James, since Paul about the subject of Jesus, why don't we go ahead and talk about that a little bit? The Bible actually does say at the end of the Gospel of John that there were many other things Jesus said and did, and there were so many of them that books, you know, numerous books could be written, and they wouldn't contain all the things that Jesus said and did. So obviously, there's more information about Jesus that could be written about. So, what does the Urantia book tell us about Jesus that we didn't know before?
Well, it does fill in many missing parts of the Bible, particularly his childhood, and most interestingly, his private ministry that took place before the public ministry, which is covered in the Bible, at least sketchy portions of it. It turns out that Jesus did do some extensive traveling throughout the kingdom of his day, and he did quite a bit of ministering to people along the way. Some of it even, you might say, anonymously. He was not speaking as some sort of a divine being at that time, but more as a teacher, a philosopher, and indeed a student of religion himself.
There are, I can just hear some listeners saying, well, yeah, but there are a lot of books out there like that claim to have the lost teachings of Jesus in them. There's the Aquarian Gospels is one. There's... you know, the Book of Mormon claims that Jesus visited America after his death. You have even the Gnostic Gospels, which claim to have some additional stuff in there about that Jesus, you know, that's not in the four Gospels or the canon. What is it for you? I don't know if you've looked at any of those other books, but what is it about the Urantia book's portrayal of Jesus that you think stands out, that makes it maybe unique or maybe, you know, different, that you think makes it more credible, say, than some of these other claims?
Well, I would say the one of the main things is how it integrates his divine and human components. It does confirm that Jesus was both divine and human, and it goes into quite a bit of detail about his previous experience as a divine being and the trials and tribulations that he went through as a human being, as a mortal of the realm. Coming to grips with his divinity, and also coming to grips with his humanity. And the way he integrated that was by remaining in communion with the Heavenly Father, with his God, and by seeking to do the Father's will at every turn. Those are the things that stand out the most to me.
I'd like Paula to jump in here for a minute, but before you do, Paula, I'd like to just give out the number again, 646-716-8158. If anybody wants to call in, please feel free, 646-716-8158. Do you have anything else to add, Paula?
Well, I just want to reiterate what James said about Jesus' private ministry in the Urantia book. To me, the Jesus part of the book is so precious, but it's because of my Judeo-Christian background. And that private ministry when he was traveling about, just doing good as he passed by, is so touching and so deeply intimate, such an intimate look into his life and his heart and his teachings and how he really made the hand of God small enough to grasp for humanity. That he, that, you know, Jesus came here to touch us where we live. And the Urantia book gives us the human Jesus as never before. Christianity has given us a lot of the divine Jesus, and that's wonderful. But it's priceless to me to have the human Jesus, the Jesus who laughed and who wept, and who prayed, and who communed with the Father, and who spent time with apostles, and ministered to the needs of people as he passed by. That's just priceless to me.
Yeah, yeah. And James, you mentioned Jesus communing with the Father, and you did as well, Paula. For those who are unfamiliar with the Urantia book definitely speaks of God as a loving Father. That's like probably the central concept in the book, isn't it? Can you talk a little more about that, James?
Well, yes, it does give an amazing portrayal of the Universal Father, even describing his abode, where he actually lives at the center of the universe, referred to as paradise. It gives an incredible background. The first third of the book really details about deity. It goes into quite a bit of detail about the Trinity arrangement of deity, but throughout all that, always, like you say, woven through it is the fact that that our Creator of not only this world but of millions of other worlds scattered throughout a huge cosmos, he is a personal Father to each and every one of us. And not only that, but he gives us a gift of his own Spirit to reside within our mind, that's always there as a guide, leading us on, helping us to do his will and to see the truth and to act in righteous ways.
Well, yeah, the
hey, you guys, segment. We have a caller. Hold on.
I'm sorry?
Hold on, we have a caller. 269, hello, welcome to Blog Talk, Cosmic Citizen.
Hello, greetings, everybody. This is Jonah from Battle Creek, Michigan.
Hey, Jonah.
Hi, Jonah.
How are you guys doing?
Good.
Good. I'm just enjoying the program, and I thought I'd call in. James, how you doing, James?
Well, I'm doing great, Jonah. Great to hear from you.
You too. It was an awesome conference. Awesome conference.
Yeah. So tell us, is there anything you want to, any questions you have or any kind of comments or anything for the listeners? Or?
Yeah,
Jonah,
I wanted to comment.
We were talking about the nature of the Universal Father just now. So.
Yeah, I didn't hear that part, but what I wanted to comment is on a comment that Paula had made about the humanity of Jesus. And I think that's so important to me and to, you know, to those who might be investigating the truths of the Urantia book, who have somewhat of a Christian background or at least a familiar biblical background. It's so important to see, you know, because people want to be able to relate, you know, to Jesus, not just as God, but as a relative, you know, close and personal, you know, friend. And what the Urantia book helped me, you know, to understand in part four is that Jesus is so much, you know, so much like us that he is very relative and very, very much attainable.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned this, John, because I want to, and I just want to let listeners know that my background is a Christian background. In fact, I was a fundamentalist Christian for many years, up until recently, actually. Have been a reader since I was 14, but kind of rejected the book for about 10 years and investigated Christianity and came back to the book. But I want everybody to know that, as far as I'm concerned, and James, I'd like you to speak to this too, as far as I'm concerned, the Urantia book, its portrayal of Jesus is completely consistent with the doctrine of the Incarnation in Christianity. The doctrine of the Incarnation says that God became man in Jesus and that Jesus was fully God and fully man. And the book says that very clearly, that he wasn't just divine, that he was fully God, that the fullness of God the Father and God the Son dwell in Jesus Christ. That particular doctrine is central to the Urantia book. I mean, it doesn't compromise on that at all. Would you agree with that, James?
Oh, absolutely. It not only confirms it, but it expands it in ways that open my eyes. I also came from a Christian background growing up. I knew from a very early age that I loved Jesus and that he loved me. But the information that I discovered in the Urantia book expanded on the personality, the loving personality of Jesus, in ways that I could not have imagined previously.
Mm. Jonah, do you have anything else to add? Hello?
I'm sorry.
I said, do you have anything else to add, Jonah?
No, I sure don't.
Okay. Well, listen, it was great having you on the show, and we're glad you're listening in.
It was great to meet you, Jonah.
Thank you.
Nice to hear you. You guys keep up the good work.
Thanks.
I just want to add.
Thanks for calling, Jonah.
Since we were talking about the Universal Father, and you were mentioning, James, the fragment of the Father that lives inside of us, that is something the Urantia book calls the Thought Adjuster. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Thought Adjuster, because it's a pretty unique concept?
Well, it is a unique concept, although it does have parallels in Christianity and a number of other religions, too. Most people might be familiar with the Atman in Hinduism, but in Christianity, it's referred to as Jesus referred to it as the kingdom of heaven within you, or the spirit in man. And the Urantia book gives an incredible explanation of this very factual indwelling of man, of the Spirit of God in man. The most unique part, I think, about it is that we have to show ourselves to be morally capable of being a co-partner with God in this life adventure, and typically we do this at a young age, between 4 and 6 years old, when we make our first moral decision regarding some aspect of our life. And at that point, that's when this fragment of God, which you referred to as the Thought Adjuster, as it is in the Urantia book, is dispatched from the Father's bosom in paradise and becomes our indwelling guide throughout our eternal career, should we choose to partner with this indwelling fragment of God. It is a potential eternal career. It is a choice. That's one thing about the Urantia book. It tells us that free will is a dominant factor throughout this life and the life beyond.
I really love the concept of the God within each one of us. And I'd like to just clarify for people that it doesn't mean we're perfect. What it means, or that we are God, but what it means is that we have a piece of perfection within us that is our guide back to the central abode, in our guide back to God in his perfection and his presence. And even Jesus said many times that the Heavenly Father has decreed that we should be perfect even as he is perfect. But he would not create such a decree without giving us a way to achieve that. And the fragment of God that lives in each human being is our way to achieve that. And it doesn't happen magically. The Urantia book says it happens over eons of time and with a great deal of effort on our part. But the good news is we have forever to get it done. And so, and James, I would like to ask you, because so much of the book is devoted to cosmology, what's your take on the cosmology of the book? And, you know, of course, our show is called The Cosmic Citizen. And so what is your idea about the title of the show, and what does that mean? How does that tie in with the Urantia book?
Ah, good question. Cosmic Citizen. Well, the maybe if we go back to the this original premise of the show of being a basic primer, we could talk about the separate parts. We could say that the Urantia book is made up of four parts, which are the central and super universe is part one. Part two is the local universe. Part three is the history of Urantia. And part four, as we've been discussing, the life and teachings of Jesus. Now, the first two parts, about one-third of the total number of the pages, which, by the way, is well over a million words, 2,097 pages, for those who aren't familiar with the text of the Urantia book, it is quite a volume. But this first third deals, begins with God, who is referred to as the Universal Father. And these two sections, they go on to describe many of the types of celestial personalities working in the universe, and also describe as well the destiny of us as evolutionary mortals. This part really gives us the sense of a cosmic perspective that you're referring to, Paula, that we are small, and yet we're not insignificant. We are part of a cosmic family of mortal beings similar to us, and also of semi-spiritual beings, and also on top of that, of true spiritual beings that are ministering to us and helping us on this this ascending path back to our source, the source of our personality and our very being, and that is God the Father.
Yeah, I'd like to just give the phone number again, 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. James, tell us a little bit. We've been talking a little bit about things like ascending path and eternal career, which may not be familiar to some listeners. Tell us, what does the Urantia book say about life after death? And how does it differ from, say, what's said in a lot of traditional religions?
Well, the Urantia book does give a detailed explanation of our journey, which, contrary to some, especially Eastern religions and some New Age thought, it does begin here. We do not have a previous existence.
Yeah.
This planet is the birth of our soul. Now, what the Urantia book talks about in quite a bit of detail is the life after this mortal realm, and we do not reincarnate, but we do repersonalize. We have many, many different worlds that we travel to. I like to tell people that while we're down here, of course, we are animal beings with a spiritual nature. But after we die, we begin the post-animal phase of this eternal career. And that does involve an adventure in learning and in serving. It's not the traditional or the naive vision of sitting on clouds and playing harps. I think most of us understand that, but it is extremely adventurous and ever beckoning us on to higher levels of service and love and this family connection as we move closer and closer to God. Now, the Urantia book does give quite a bit of detail about this, the intervening level of reality, which it denotes with a coined word called Morantia. And it's sort of it defines it as an intervening level. When we start here as animal, we have so far to go before we become spirit that it requires this sort of an in-between level where we are shedding the remnants of our animal legacy, our stubborn self-will, and increasingly adopting the divine will as our purpose and our direction.
You know, I love that, James, and you know, just the whole notion that we don't live this life and learn these lessons, how, you know, this is a hard life, and it's fraught with difficulty and relationship and interpersonal experiences, and we learn these lessons of brotherhood and altruism and family life, and they're such beautiful lessons, and it's so sad to me to think that you die and it's all for naught, it's all forgotten. But, you know, the Urantia book says uncategorically that does not happen, that the lessons we learn on this world we take with us, they become a part of our eternal self and endowment, and Jesus said, you know, to lay up your treasures in heaven, and those are our treasures, those beautiful experiences we have and those memories. But I'd like to share just a quote because of what you were saying. It really touched on a quote that I always hold, and I hope from time to time we can share a taste of the Urantia book because it is so beautiful in its language and its writing. This is from paper 14, Life in Havona, and it says about us mortals, it says this: love of adventure, curiosity, and the dread of monotony. These traits, inherent in evolving human nature, were not put there just to aggravate and annoy you during your short sojourn on Earth, but rather to suggest to you that death is only the beginning of an endless career of adventure, an everlasting life of anticipation, an eternal voyage of discovery.
You know, one of the things, Paul, that I came up with this analogy kind of that helps explain it, I think, to people, that we don't just become perfect right away overnight when we die. We don't just go to heaven right away. It's not like God waves a magic wand and we become perfect. and you mentioned that the perfection, that we will eventually become perfect, but it's going to take eons and eons of time and effort on our part. Yes, it will take effort on our part, but there's also grace in this process. We get a lot of help. For example, this is the way I look at it, growth is the natural order of things. So just as a fetus becomes a baby, and a baby becomes a toddler, and a toddler becomes a child, and a child becomes an adolescent, and so on and so forth. So in the same way, we as human beings will enter the next stage. You know, we're like little spiritual fetuses here. You know, and the next stage will be babies, and then the next stage will be toddlers. It's not reincarnation. What they're talking about is being resurrected into a higher state. But we're going to go, you know, we're just going to go into the next stage and the next stage, and it's a slow growing process. It's a gentle process. It's not a process that is, I don't see it as a high pressure process. I don't see, and the thing that's really great about this is, yes, it's by our own efforts, but there's also a lot of grace. For example, when we get to the next life, we're going to have better brains. We're going to have better bodies. We're going to have all kinds of, we're going to have a new body. We're going to have all kinds of help and assistance that is going to help us adjust to the world that we're going to be a part of.
I think that's so true, Andre, and it's a very, very good point.
So, James, tell us, I think Paula, Paula mentioned that, you know, death is not the end, okay? Now, the Urantia book does not teach the concept of hell, of eternal punishment, but it does say that people can, if they really want to, they can reject God. And what happens to people who reject God, and how does that happen? I mean, I would think that, from my understanding of the Urantia book, it takes a lot of hard work to reject God. You've got to really want to reject God. And what happens to people who do?
Well, the Urantia book does go into a good bit of detail about that. It's hard to touch on that in just a short space, but again, free will is the mandate, as well as perfection. We don't have to accept the Father's invitation to become perfect. And indeed, some people might find that not to their liking. Now, we don't exactly know any sort of ratio about how many people eventually choose the eternal life of loving service and those who choose not to accept it. But there is no hell, as you mentioned. There is no damnation or torture that's totally against any kind of a notion of a loving Father, which in the Urantia book theology repeatedly points back to to God as a loving father. As we know, a loving father would never subject his children to any kind of torture or harsh reality. So at some point, if an ascending personality chooses not to go forward, they simply become as if they never were. But this happens after a review. There are high angels. They're actually called the Ancients of Days. They act in as a trio, three of them, that serve to judge whether a person is capable and willing to continue on. And if they are not, then they become as if they never were. However, everything that they did attain as far as value goes into another subject that the Urantia book touches on, called the Supreme Being, which is an evolving deity of experience, where all these experiences, whether they're positive or negative, are contributing to an evolving deity called the Supreme Being.
So what you're saying is that basically when you say they become as though they never were, that essentially they cease to exist. They know, and the way I look at this, I like to tell people, you know, I think the book says the farther and farther, the closer and closer we get to God, the more real we become. And the farther and farther we get away from God, the less real we become. So there's, if you reject God, you're rejecting reality. So what you're really saying is, I don't want to be a part of reality. So you get your wish, you know. But that's something that, it's not like you just get zapped. Because, I mean, there are a lot of people in this life, for example, my father, who I think thought he was an atheist. But that doesn't mean he rejected God. You know, the book says that God honors the faintest flicker of faith in a person. So even if a person thinks that they're an atheist in this life, a lot of those so-called atheists, I believe, will be resurrected anyway and be given an opportunity to make a fully informed choice. That's one of the things the book says, is that everybody will be given an opportunity to make a fully informed choice.
You know, Andre, I love the analogy of that Jesus gave us of the vine and the branches. Because if you cut yourself off from the vine, what will sustain your life? A branch that cuts itself off from the source of all that sustains its life will cease to exist. And it's just, it's not just a metaphor, it's literal. You simply can't cut yourself off from the source of all life in the universe of universes and expect to continue to exist. And so it's, you know, our job then becomes to draw as close to that source as we can and draw from it as much life and beauty and truth and goodness as we can, so that we can become a channel for that for every other sentient being in the universe of universes, and therefore create abundant life, as Jesus said.
Yes.
By becoming like that source, a true vine, and bearing much fruit. That is the evidence that you are attached to that vine, you know? You really are tapped into that source because you're bearing that abundant fruit. That's the evidence of it. So even though somebody might say, I'm an atheist, I have come to believe that often it's religions and organized religions that they are rejecting and not God.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, Paula. That's how I feel about my father. I don't think he rejected God. He just rejected a lot of the guilt and fear that he grew up with in his organized religion. Absolutely. And let me also, and you mentioned, James, that a loving father would not create a place of eternal punishment or torture for his children, which I agree. Now, the Urantia book also rejects the idea that God is wrathful or vengeful or angry. Now, this may seem self-evident to a lot of people, but maybe I'm really going to basics here. But why does the book reject that? And what does the book say about those concepts and how they came into human religions?
Well, That's a pretty tall question, Andre. What I would say that the Urantia book, it defines the origin and nature of faith and morality while affirming the mandate of free will, but also it updates our definitions of error, evil, sin, and iniquity. And it gives us some powerful new definitions, some places to reconcile these notions that have carried forth from evolutionary religions. Now, one very important element of the Urantia book is that it describes the process of revelation to a planet like ours, and that it definitely goes through a prescribed series of revelations that are given by the universe personalities who do serve and teach us. The Urantia book claims to be the fifth in a series of epical revelations that were given to this planet, and all of the basic religions that we have that you're speaking about are derived from these epical revelations. Some of them have been recounted throughout time, have come down to us through myth, ancient beings who came to teach this world advanced concepts and settle us into civilization. And all of these things have influenced the evolutionary religions that we have, all of the major, especially the monotheistic religions. But over time, the human element creeps in, and these religions become increasingly humanized, just like we're talking about a wrathful father. Well, we know we have wrathful fathers in this world, but our Heavenly Father isn't that way. And it takes periodic reconnections with God to correct some of this confusion that we have in evolutionary religion. That's actually the Urantia book describes its purpose as coming, being a gift to us to help alleviate this confusion that we've had since 2,000 years ago, the last epical revelation of truth, which was the life and teachings of Jesus. So it serves quite a great purpose in reconciling and updating these various things in religious doctrine and dogma.
You know, James, I think it's so important to hone in on this idea that our ideas of religion evolve, and the Bible is a great example of that, in that it shows in the Old Testament that kind of angry, wrathful God, but then culminates in the New Testament, which is a new revelation of the loving God, which Jesus made. So we see right there in that one religious text an evolution of human thinking from angry, wrathful to this beautiful portrayal that Jesus made of loving, merciful, you know?
Right. And Paula, how are we doing on time here?
Right now, we got 14 minutes, Andre.
Okay. James, you know, there's so many questions we could ask, so many topics we could cover in the book, but I was going to ask you about what epical revelations are, because the book claims, as you said, to be the fifth epochal revelation. That's spelled E-P-O-C-H-A-L, like an epoch or an era. What is the purpose of revelation? As I understand the book, revelation is there to sort of help guide evolution. And the book does portray an evolutionary universe and an evolutionary paradigm of human existence that is guided by God and by angels and all kinds of orders of celestial beings. But the purpose of revelation is to guide evolution. So what were the previous four epochal revelations? And why don't we start with the first one? What was their purpose?
Well, the first one, Andre, occurred a long time ago. One thing that we should say is that the Urantia book does expand our timelines for human evolution on this planet. The Dalmatia teachings were the first epical revelation and consisted of a commission of celestial beings who did come to our planet to help upstep our understandings about God, and that happened 500,000 years ago. And they came and did the best they could with the primitive beings of the time. The next epical revelation didn't occur until approximately 37,000 years ago, and that was the Edenic teachings, or as we know them from the myths and stories of Adam and Eve that have survived not only in the Bible, but in cultures and religions throughout the world.
Let me stop you for 1 second, because I want to make sure people understand that Adam and Eve, according to the Arash book, were not the first people on Earth. Who were Adam and Eve?
Adam and Eve were also celestial beings. They're noted in the Urantia book as being material sons and daughters. They are descending children of God who are who take missions to come to evolutionary planets such as ours to upgrade not only us biologically, but also morally and spiritually. And typically, they create a center of influence, which in our case was called the Garden of Eden, and they set out to upstep and upgrade a whole planet. And typically, this happens quite well on our planet. We've had some interruptions and some defaults, which people listening in that don't know about the Urantia book would be quite intrigued to get a better understanding of why this planet is confused, why we're sort of off the tracks in some of our understandings, especially about the nature of God and religion. There are real reasons why this confusion has happened, and there are some very, I say, intriguing details about this. The Lucifer Rebellion is something that comes to mind, and also the default of Adam and Eve in the second revelation, epical revelation, as we refer to it.
James,
now the to carry forward the third epical revelation was this this figure that is sort of a mysterious figure known as Melchizedek. He is mentioned in the Bible, but in cryptic ways. We're not told much about him. This was another teacher being, a celestial being who came down here to help upgrade the religions at the time and also to prepare the way to create help create a monotheistic religion where Jesus could, on his upcoming mission, would have a little more to work with, as you might say. He was an emergency bestowal and became the mentor of Abraham and basically initiated much of the information we have that's survived in the Hebrew religion. The fourth epical revelation, according to the Urantia book, was the life of Jesus. And there's volumes of information, as we've talked about. The last third of the book is related to this revelation of a divine creator being who came down here to bestow himself on this planet and show us the better way into how we can be humanly divine as he was. And, of course, we could say a lot more about that. But to carry forward, the fifth epical revelation, the Urantia book refers to itself as the fifth epical revelation of truth to our world, Urantia. And it's a composite work, as we've talked about, by many different types of celestial personalities.
I would just like to clarify something, too, for people, and that is the fact that a concept basic to the Urantia book is that, as James said earlier, the universe is teeming with life. And the first two parts of the book really give you an expansive idea about just how teeming with life the universe of universes is. Seven super universes, each containing a possible trillion inhabitable worlds. So there are trillions and trillions of beings, intelligent free will beings, who are learning to know God and who are trying to become perfect even as God is perfect, just as we are. The Urantia book says that worlds like ours evolve pretty much the same. And there are seven basic earmarks of evolution, and each one of these earmarks is characterized by what the Urantia book calls an epical revelation. That's a revelation from the universe to the world. But it also says that there is an equally important type of revelation that it terms in an auto-revelation. And because God lives in each human being, any one of us can bring forth, be a fount of truth to the world if we allow God to use us in that way. And so those revelations, auto-revelations, are important as well. Truth can come from many sources. But these epical revelations are all important in our evolution as a world. And as James said, we came to get out of step with normal evolutionary ideas and practices in the universe. So the Urantia book really clarifies that, and I find that clarification allows me to forgive the world for being a bit messed up, to put it frankly. So
the other thing is that, you know, even I want to also clarify, and I mean, we only have about 7 or 8 minutes left, I think, but and if anybody wants to call in, you have your last few minutes here, 646-716-8158, 646-716-8158. I want to also say that even though the book says that our goal in eternity is perfection, that is eventually the goal of all this ascension, all these lives that we're going to be living, all these different worlds we're going to be going through, that is our ultimate goal. I don't think the book preaches a kind of neurotic perfectionism. It doesn't say, you better be perfect now. You know, we've got an eternity to do this. And the other thing is, you know, the book, as you mentioned, Paula, it allows us to forgive the world for being so messed up. You know, we were created imperfect on purpose so that we could grow. That's the whole point. So we are supposed to be imperfect right now. So that, you know, this is not, people, you know, that's what makes it, I think, easier for us to forgive. Because we understand that these people that we're, you know, bumping up side by side with every day and people like us, that we're, you know, we're supposed to be imperfect. We're not supposed to be perfect right now.
Well, yeah, we evolve just like children evolve. We start inexperienced and young and like a clean slate. And we add to that experience every day. Each year we grow and evolve. It's a natural process. It's not a sinful thing. It's a beautiful thing. You just have to learn to see it as a beautiful thing. You know, mistakes, Jesus called experience the master teacher. And that's so true. And when you can forgive yourself for being imperfect, then you can allow yourself to grow. And you can forgive our world for being imperfect. It's just the way we are. We have our work cut out for us, and what's wrong with that? That's fine.
Yes. Yes.
I'd like to add to that something that I take as a personal teaching from the Urantia book as a guide, and I call it PTF. It's an easy way for me to try to remember these things we're talking about. On page 1580 in the Urantia book, when they're speaking about Jesus, they say, "It seemed to be his purpose in all social situations to teach patience, tolerance, and forgiveness." And so I try to keep those in my heart and remember those by the PTF. It's a nice little reminder cue for me.
Mm. I love that, James. You know, we're getting down to 4 minutes now and kind of wrap it up, so I'm just giving us a reminder.
Sure. James, I guess since we only have about 4 minutes left, James, if someone were to be listening to this show and say, "Well, why should I bother looking at the Urantia book?" And what would your response to that person be?
Well, I would say that I can only speak from personal experience, and that's something that the Urantia book talks about. It doesn't redefine religion, but it does expand our understanding of religion, and it speaks of it in terms of true religion or the religion of the spirit. And it always speaks of that as being a personal experience of your relationship with God the Father. It goes back over and over to personal relationship. And in the Urantia book has, as I mentioned earlier, over 1 million words. And words are great. And they do give us an insight, a better knowledge into this world of religion. But really, the experience of communion with the Father, prayer, worship, and communion, meditation, however you call it, is really the key to our evolution, our personal evolution, which is also the key to our planetary evolution. And the Urantia book has helped me to see those things, to be able to understand them both intellectually and spiritually in ways that I wouldn't have even couldn't have imagined before I read the Urantia book and had this expanded understanding.
That's so beautiful and so true. And, you know, I think that the Urantia book does that for everybody who reads it, who really reads it with an open mind and an open heart. It expands you. It liberates you. I can't help but think of Jesus' words again where he says, "You will know the truth and the truth will make you free." And I've wondered, what will the truth make you free of? And after reading the Urantia book, I know exactly. It will make you free of fear, shame, blame, doubt, guilt, all of those things that hold you down as a child of God and don't allow you to grow and experience true joy in a wonderful, friendly universe where everything is provided for your growth.
Mm.
And yeah, that's liberating, and I've come to know truth by its liberating qualities.
I want to just give, if anybody is interested in emailing me, you can do so. If you want to know more about the Urantia book, you can email me at cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. That's cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. And Paula, do you have an? I don't know if you're comfortable with this. Do you have an email address that people can contact you if you?
Sure. U Books R Us. That's UBOOKSRUS@AOL.com.
Great. Well, I don't know how much more time we've got left. What is it, 1 minute, 2 minutes?
Well, we've got 56 seconds.
Okay. Well, James, I really appreciate you being on the show with us. Thank you so much. And I just really thank you for this basic overview. Next week, we're going to be talking about part one of the book with Chris Halverson, who is just a really gifted speaker as well. We're going to be talking about part one. We're going to be talking about the foreword, which are probably the most complicated parts of the book, or at least in certain passages. So, you know, again, we look forward to doing the show again next week. And, James, I just want to thank you again so much for being gracious enough to be on with us today.
Thank you, James.
Well, thank you, Andre and Paula. It's been a pleasure. Glad to do whatever I could here. I'd like to sign off, if I can, by saying there's seven words on page 2064 that summarize our mission to manifest the Father in our hearts and the kingdom in our community. And they are unfailing forgiveness, matchless goodwill, and abounding love. And those are the spiritual weapons that the teachers of this new religion are equipped with. And I would say that wherever you find yourself on the journey of spirit discovery, these seven words perfectly define your destination.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again for being with us. And Paula, thanks a lot for being with me. And we'll be doing another show next week.
Okay. Bye for now.
Thanks a lot.